This is Audible.
Recorded Books presents an unabridged recording of All the Pretty Horses by Cormac McCarthy, narrated by Frank Muller. This book is copyrighted 1992 by Cormac McCarthy. This recording is copyrighted 1992 by Recorded Books. The year is 1949. What should be a time of beginning has become a time of ending, of dying. At 16, John Grady Cole is in search of a new life, a new land, a new dream. And now, All the Pretty Horses.
Part 1. The candle flame and the image of the candle flame caught in the pier glass twisted and righted when he entered the hall and again when he shut the door. He took off his hat and came slowly forward. The floorboards creaked under his boots. In his black suit he stood in the dark glass where the lilies leaned so palely from their wasted cut-glass vase. Along the cold hallway behind him hung the portraits of forebears only dimly known to him, all framed in glass and dimly lit above the narrow wainscoting. He looked down at the guttered candlestick. He pressed his thumbprint in the warm wax pooled on the oak veneer. Lastly, he looked at the face, so caved and drawn among the folds of funeral cloth, the yellowed mustache, the eyelids paper-thin. That was not sleeping. That was not sleeping. It was dark outside and cold and no wind. In the distance, a calf bawled. He stood with his hat in his hand. "You never combed your hair that way in your life," he said. Inside the house, there was no sound save the ticking of the mantel clock in the front room. He went out and shut the door. Dark and cold and no wind and a thin gray reef beginning along the eastern rim of the world. He walked out on the prairie and stood holding his hat like some supplicant to the darkness over them all, and he stood there for a long time. As he turned to go, he heard the train. He stopped and waited for it. He could feel it under his feet. It came boring out of the east like some ribald satellite of the coming sun, howling and bellowing in the distance, and the long light of the headlamp running through the tangled mesquite breaks and creating out of the night the endless fence line down the dead straight right-of-way and sucking it back again, wire and post, mile on mile into the darkness after where the boiler smoke disbanded slowly along a faint new horizon, and the sound came lagging, and he stood still holding his hat in his hands in the passing ground shutter, watching it till it was gone. Then he turned and went back to the house. She looked up from the stove when he came in and looked him up and down in his suit. "Buenos dias, guapo," she said. He hung the hat on a peg by the door among slickers and blanket coats and odd pieces of tack and came to the stove and got his coffee and took it to the table. She opened the oven and drew out a pan of sweet rolls she'd made and put one on a plate and brought it over and set it in front of him together with a knife for the butter. And she touched the back of his head with her hand before she returned to the stove. "I appreciate you lighting the candle," he said.
"Cómo?"
"La candela, la vela."
"No fui yo," she said.
"La señora?"
"Claro."
"No se levanto?"
"Antes que yo."
He drank the coffee. It was just grainy light outside, and Arturo was coming up toward the house. He saw his father at the funeral, standing by himself across the little gravel path near the fence. Once he went out to the street to his car, then he came back. A norther had blown in about mid-morning, and there were spits of snow in the air with blowing dust, and the women sat holding onto their hats. They put an awning up over the gravesite, but the weather was all sideways, and it did no good. The canvas rattled and flapped, and the preacher's words were lost in the wind. When it was over and the mourners rose to go, the canvas chairs they'd been sitting on raced away, tumbling among the tombstones. In the evening he saddled his horse and rode out west from the house. The wind was much abated, and it was very cold, and the sun sat blood-red and elliptic under the reefs of blood-red cloud before him. He rode where he would always choose to ride, out where the western fork of the old Comanche Road, coming down out of the Kiowa country to the north, passed through the westernmost section of the ranch, and you could see the faint trace of it bearing south over the low prairie that lay between the north and middle forks of the Concho River. At the hour he'd always choose, when the shadows were long and the ancient road was shaped before him in the rose and canted light like a dream of the past, where the painted ponies and the riders of that lost nation came down out of the north with their faces chalked and their long hair plaited, and each armed for war, which was their life, and the women and children and women with children at their breasts, all of them pledged in blood and redeemable in blood only. When the wind was in the north, you could hear them. The horses and the breath of the horses, and the horses' hooves that were shod in rawhide, and the rattle of lances, and the constant drag of the travois poles in the sand like the passing of some enormous serpent, and the young boys naked on wild horses, jaunty as circus riders, and hazing wild horses before them, and the dogs trotting with their tongues alol, and foot slaves following half-naked and sorely burdened, and above all, the low chant of their traveling song, which the riders sang as they rode, nation and ghost of nation passing in a soft chorale across that mineral waste to darkness, bearing, lost to all history and all remembrance like a grail, the sum of their secular and transitory and violent lives. He rode with the sun coppering his face and the red wind blowing out of the west. He turned south along the old war trail, and he rode out to the crest of a low rise and dismounted, and dropped the reins and walked out, and stood like a man come to the end of something. There was an old horse skull in the brush, and he squatted and picked it up and turned it in his hands. Frail and brittle, bleached paper white. He squatted in the long light, holding it, the comic book teeth loose in their sockets, the joints in the cranium like a ragged welding of the bone plates, the muted run of sand in the brain box when he turned it. What he loved in horses was what he loved in men, the blood and the heat of the blood that ran them. All his reverence and all his fondness and all the leanings of his life were for the ardent-hearted, and they would always be so and never be otherwise. He rode back in the dark. The horse quickened its step. The last of the day's light fanned slowly upon the plain behind him and withdrew again down the edges of the world in a cooling blue of shadow and dusk and chill and a few last chitterings of birds sequestered in the dark and wiry brush. He crossed the old trace again, and he must turn the pony up onto the plain and homeward. But the warriors would ride on in that darkness they'd become, rattling past with their Stone Age tools of war and default of all substance, and singing softly in blood and longing south across the plains to Mexico. The house was built in 1872. 77 years later, his grandfather was still the first man to die in it. But others had lain in state in that hallway, had been carried there on a gate or wrapped in a wagon sheet, or delivered, crated up in a raw pine-board box with a teamster standing at the door with a bill of lading, the ones that came at all. For the most part, they were dead by rumor, a yellowed scrap of newsprint, a letter, a telegram. The original ranch was 2,300 acres out of the old Moisebach survey of the Fisher-Miller grant. The original house, a one-room hovel of sticks and wattle. That was in 1866. In that same year, the first cattle were driven through what was still Bear County and across the north end of the ranch and on to Fort Sumner and Denver. 5 years later, his great-grandfather sent 600 steers over that same trail, and with the money he built the house, and by then the ranch was already 18,000 acres. In 1883, they ran the first barbed wire. By 86, the buffalo were gone. That same winter, a bad die-up. In 89, Fort Concho was disbanded. His grandfather was the oldest of eight boys, and the only one to live past the age of 25. They were drowned, shot, kicked by horses. They perished in fires. They seemed to fear only dying in bed. The last two were killed in Puerto Rico in 1898, and in that year he married and brought his bride home to the ranch, and he must have walked out and stood looking at his holdings and reflected long upon the ways of God and the laws of primogeniture. 12 years later, when his wife was carried off in the influenza epidemic, they still had no children. A year later, he married his dead wife's older sister, and a year after this, the boy's mother was born. And that was all the mourning that there was. The Grady name was buried with that old man the day the norther blew the lawn chairs over the dead cemetery grass. The boy's name was Cole. John Grady Cole. He met his father in the lobby of the St. Angelus, and they walked up Chadbourne Street to the Eagle Cafe and sat in a booth at the back. Some at the table stopped talking when they came in. A few men nodded to his father, and one said his name. The waitress called everybody Doll. She took their order and flirted with him. His father took out his cigarettes and lit one and put the pack on the table and put his 3rd Infantry Zippo lighter on top of it and leaned back and smoked and looked at him. He told him his uncle Ed Allison had gone up to the preacher after the funeral was said and shook his hand. The two of them standing there holding onto their hats and leaning 30 degrees into the wind like vaudeville comics, while the canvas flacked and raged about them and the funeral attendants raced over the grounds after the lawn chairs. And he'd leaned into the preacher's face and screamed at him that it was a good thing they'd held the burial that morning, because the way it was making up, this thing could turn off into a real blow before the day was out. His father laughed silently. Then he fell to coughing. He took a drink of water and sat, smoking and shaking his head. Buddy, when he come back from up in the panhandle, told me one time it quit blowing up there, and all the chickens fell over. The waitress brought their coffee.
Here you go, Doll, she said. I'll have your all's orders up in just a minute.
She's gone to San Antonio, the boy said. Don't call her she. Mama. I know it. They drank their coffee.
What do you aim to do?
About what?
About anything.
She can go where she wants to. The boy watched him.
You ain't got no business smoking them things, he said.
His father pursed his lips and drummed his fingers on the table and looked up.
When I come around asking you what I'm supposed to do, you'll know you're big enough to tell me, he said.
Yes, sir.
You need any money?
No.
He watched the boy. He'll be all right, he said.
The waitress brought their dinner, thick china lunch plates with steak and gravy and potatoes and beans.
I'll get your all's bread.
His father tucked his napkin into his shirt.
It ain't me I was worried about, the boy said.
Can I say that? His father took up his knife and cut into the steak.
Yeah, he said, you can say that.
The waitress brought the basket of rolls and set it on the table and went away. They ate. His father didn't eat much. After a while, he pushed the plate back with his thumb and reached and got another cigarette and tapped it against the lighter and put it in his mouth and lit it.
You can say whatever's on your mind. Hell, you can bitch at me about smoking if you want.
The boy didn't answer.
You know it ain't what I wanted, don't you?
Yeah, I know that.
You looking after Roscoe good?
He ain't been rode.
Why don't we go Saturday?
All right.
You don't have to if you got something else to do.
I ain't got nothing else to do. His father smoked. He watched him.
We don't have to if you don't want to, he said.
I want to.
Can you and Arturo load and pick me up in town?
Yeah.
What time? What time will you be up? I'll get up. We'll be there late. I'll be up. The boy nodded. He ate. His father looked around. I wonder who you need to see in this place to get some coffee, he said. He and Rawlins had unsaddled the horses and turned them out in the dark, and they were lying on the saddle blankets and using the saddles for pillows. The night was cold and clear, and the sparks rising from the fire raced hot and red among the stars. They could hear the trucks out on the highway, and they could see the lights of the town reflected off the desert 15 miles to the north.
What do you aim to do? Rawlins said.
I don't know. Nothing.
I don't know what you expect. Him 2 years older than you, got his own car and everything.
There ain't nothing to him, never was.
What did she say?
She didn't say nothing. What would she say? There ain't nothing to say.
Well, I don't know what you expect.
I don't expect nothing.
You going on Saturday?
No. Rawlins took a cigarette out of his shirt pocket and sat up and took a coal from the fire and lit the cigarette. He sat, smoking.
I wouldn't let her get the best of me, he said.
He tipped the ash from the end of the cigarette against the heel of his boot.
She ain't worth it. None of them are.
He didn't answer for a while. Then he said, yes, they are. When he got back, he rubbed down the horse and put him up and walked up to the house to the kitchen. Louisa had gone to bed and the house was quiet. He put his hand on the coffee pot to test it, and he took down a cup and poured it and walked out and up the hallway. He entered his grandfather's office and went to the desk and turned on the lamp and sat down in the old oak swivel chair. On the desk was a small brass calendar mounted on swivels that changed dates when you tipped it over in its stand. It still said September 13th. An ashtray, a glass paperweight, a blotter that said Palmer Feed and Supply, his mother's high school graduation picture in a small silver frame. The room smelled of old cigar smoke. He leaned and turned off the little brass lamp and sat in the dark. Through the front window he could see the starlit prairie falling away to the north. The black crosses of the old telegraph poles yoked across the constellations passing east to west. His grandfather said the Comanche would cut the wires and splice them back with horsehair. He leaned back and crossed his boots on the desktop. Dry lightning to the north, 40 miles distant. The clock struck 11 in the front room across the hall. She came down the stairs and stood in the office doorway and turned on the wall switch light. She was in her robe, and she stood with her arms cradled against her, her elbows in her palms. He looked at her and looked out the window again. What are you doing? She said. Setting. She stood there in her robe for a long time. Then she turned and went back down the hall and up the stairs again. When he heard her door close, he got up and turned off the light. There were a few last warm days yet, and in the afternoon sometimes he and his father would sit in the hotel room in the white wicker furniture with the window open and the thin crocheted curtains blowing into the room, and they'd drink coffee, and his father would pour a little whiskey in his own cup and sit sipping it and smoking and looking down at the street. There were oil field scouts' cars parked along the street that looked like they'd been in a war zone. If you had the money, would you buy it? The boy said. I had the money and I didn't.
You mean your back pay from the army?
No, since then.
What's the most you ever won?
You don't need to know. Learn bad habits.
Why don't I bring the chessboard up some afternoon?
I ain't got the patience to play.
You got the patience to play poker.
That's different.
What's different about it?
Money is what's different about it.
They sat.
There's still a lot of money in the ground out there, his father said. Number one I.C. Clark that come in last year was a big well.
He sipped his coffee. He reached and got his cigarettes off the table and lit one and looked at the boy and looked down at the street again. After a while, he said, "I won $26,000 in 22 hours of play. There's $4,000 in the last pot, three of us in, two boys from Houston. I won the hand with three natural queens." He turned and looked at the boy. The boy sat with the cup in front of him, halfway to his mouth. He turned and looked back out the window. "I don't have a dime of it," he said. "What do you think I should do?" "I don't think there's much you can do." "Will you talk to her?" "I can't talk to her." "You could talk to her. Last conversation we had was in San Diego, California in 1942. Well, it ain't her fault. I ain't the same as I was. I'd like to think I am, but I ain't." "You are inside. Inside you are." His father coughed. He drank from his cup. "Inside," he said. They sat for a long time. "She's in a play or something over there." "Yeah, I know." The boy reached and got his hat off the floor and put it on his knee. "I'll better get back," he said. "You know I fought the world in that old man, don't you?" The boy looked out the window. "Yeah," he said. "Don't go to crying on me now."
"I ain't."
"Well, don't." "He never give up," the boy said. "He was the one told me not to. He said, let's not have a funeral till we got something to bury, if it ain't nothing but his dog tags. They were fixing to give your clothes away." His father smiled. "We might as well have," he said. "Only thing fit me was the boots." "He always thought you all would get back together." "Yeah, I know he did." The boy stood and put on his hat. "I better get on back," he said. "He used to get in fights over her, even as an old man. Anybody said anything about her, if he heard about it, wasn't even dignified." "I better get on." "Well." He unpropped his feet from the windowsill. "I'll walk down with you. I need to get the paper." They stood in the tiled lobby while his father scanned the headlines. "How can Shirley Temple be getting divorced?" he said. He looked up. Early winter twilight in the streets. "I might just get a haircut," he said. He looked at the boy. "I know how you feel. I felt the same way." The boy nodded. His father looked at the paper again and folded it. "The good book says that the meek shall inherit the earth, and I expect that's probably the truth. Now, I ain't no free thinker, but I'll tell you what, I'm a long way from being convinced that it's all that good a thing." He looked at the boy. He took his key out of his coat pocket and handed it to him. "Go on back up there, or something belongs to you in the closet." The boy took the key. "What is it?" he said. "Just something I got for you. I was going to give it to you at Christmas, but I'm tired of walking over it." "Yes, sir." "Anyway, you look like you could use some cheering up. Just leave the key at the desk when you come down."
"Yes, sir.
I'll see you."
"All right."
He rode back up in the elevator and walked down the hall and put the key in the door and walked in and went to the closet and opened it. Standing on the floor, along with two pairs of boots and a pile of dirty shirts, was a brand-new Hamley Formfitter saddle. He picked it up by the horn and shut the closet door and carried it to the bed and swung it up and stood looking at it. "Hell, fire, and damnation," he said. He left the key at the desk and swung out through the doors into the street with the saddle over his shoulder. He walked down the South Concho Street and swung the saddle down and stood it in front of him. It was just dark and the street lights had come on. The first vehicle along was a Model A Ford truck, and it came skidding quarterwise to a halt on its mechanical brakes, and the driver leaned across and rolled down the window partway and boomed at him in a whiskey voice, "Throw that hull up in the bed, cowboy, and get in here."
"Yes, sir,"
he said. It rained all the following week and cleared. Then it rained again. It beat down without mercy on the hard, flat plains. The water was over the highway bridge at Cristoval, and the road was closed. Floods in San Antonio. In his grandfather's slicker, he rode the Alicia pasture, where the south fence was standing in water to the top wire. The cattle stood, islanded, staring bleakly at the rider. Redbow stood staring bleakly at the cattle. He pressed his horse's flanks between his boot heels. "Come on," he said. "I don't like it no better than you do." He and Luisa and Arturo ate in the kitchen while she was gone. Sometimes at night after supper he'd walk out to the road and catch a ride into town and walk the streets. Or he'd stand outside the hotel on Beauregard Street and look up at the room on the fourth floor where his father's shape or father's shadow would pass behind the gauzy window curtains and then turn and pass back again like a sheet-iron bear in a shooting gallery, only slower, thinner, more agonized. When she came back, they ate in the dining room again. The two of them at opposite ends of the long walnut table while Luisa made the service. She carried out the last of the dishes and turned at the door.
"Algo más, señora?"
"No, Luisa. Gracias.
Buenas noches, señora."
"Buenas noches." The door closed. The clock ticked. He looked up. "Why couldn't you lease me the ranch?"
"Lease you the ranch?"
"Yes."
"I thought I said I didn't want to discuss it."
"This is a new subject."
"No, it's not."
"I'd give you all the money. You could do whatever you wanted."
"All the money. You don't know what you're talking about. There's not any money. This place has barely paid expenses for 20 years. There hasn't been a white person worked here since before the war. Anyway, you're 16 years old. You can't run a ranch."
"Yes, I can."
"You're being ridiculous. You have to go to school."
She put the napkin on the table and pushed back her chair and rose and went out. He pushed away the coffee cup in front of him. He leaned back in the chair. On the wall opposite, above the sideboard, was an oil painting of horses. There were half a dozen of them breaking through a pole corral, and their manes were long and blowing and their eyes wild. They'd been copied out of a book. They had the long Andalusian nose, and the bones of their faces showed barb blood. You could see the hindquarters of the foremost few, good hindquarters and heavy enough to make a cutting horse, as if maybe they had steel dust in their blood. But nothing else matched, and no such horse ever was that he had seen, and he'd once asked his grandfather what kind of horses they were. And his grandfather looked up from his plate at the painting as if he'd never seen it before, and he said, "Those are picture book horses," and went on eating. He went up the stairs to the mezzanine and found Franklin's name lettered in an arc across the pebbled glass of the door, and took off his hat and turned the knob and went in. The girl looked up from her desk.
"I'm here to see Mr. Franklin," he said.
"Did you have an appointment?"
"No, ma'am. He knows me."
"What's your name?"
"John Grady Cole."
"Just a minute."
She went into the other room. Then she came out and nodded. He rose and crossed the room.
"Come in, son," said Franklin.
He walked in.
"Sit down."
He sat. When he'd said what he had to say, Franklin leaned back and looked out the window. He shook his head. He turned back and folded his hands on the desk in front of him.
"In the first place," he said, "I'm not really at liberty to advise you. It's called conflict of interest. But I think I can tell you that it is her property, and she can do whatever she wants with it."
"I don't have any say-so."
"You're a minor."
"What about my father?"
Franklin leaned back.
"That's a sticky issue," he said.
"They ain't divorced."
"Yes, they are."
The boy looked up.
"It's a matter of public record, so I don't guess it's out of confidence. It was in the paper."
"When?"
"It was made final 3 weeks ago."
He looked down. Franklin watched him. It was final before the old man died. The boy nodded. I see what you're saying, he said. It's a sorry piece of business, son. But I think the way it is the way it's going to be. Couldn't you talk to her?
I did talk to her.
What did she say?
Well, it don't matter what she said. She ain't going to change her mind.
He nodded. He sat looking down into his hat. Son, not everybody thinks that life on a cattle ranch in West Texas is the second best thing to dying and going to heaven. She don't want to live out there, that's all. If it was a paying proposition, that'd be one thing, but it ain't.
It could be.
Well, I don't aim to get any discussion about that. Anyway, she's a young woman, and my guess is she'd like to have a little more social life than what she's had to get used to. She's 36 years old. The lawyer leaned back. He swiveled slightly in the chair. He tapped his lower lip with his forefinger. It's his own damned fault. He signed every paper they put in front of him. Never lifted a hand to save himself. Hell, I couldn't tell him. I told him to get a lawyer. Told. I begged him.
Yeah, I know.
Wayne tells me he's quit going to the doctor. He nodded. Yeah. Well, I thank you for your time. I'm sorry not to have better news for you. You're damn sure welcome to talk to somebody else.
That's all right.
What are you doing out of school today?
I laid out.
The lawyer nodded. Well, he said that would explain it. The boy rose and put on his hat. Thanks, he said. The lawyer stood. Some things in this world can't be helped, he said, and I believe this is probably one of them.
Yeah,
the boy said. After Christmas, she was gone all the time. He and Luisa and Arturo sat in the kitchen. Luisa couldn't talk about it without crying, so they didn't talk about it. No one had even told her mother, who'd been on the ranch since before the turn of the century. Finally, Arturo had to tell her. She listened and nodded and turned away, and that was all. In the morning, he was standing by the side of the road at daybreak with a clean shirt and a pair of socks in a leather satchel, together with his toothbrush and razor and shaving brush. The satchel had belonged to his grandfather, and the blanket-lined ducking coat he wore had been his father's. The first car that passed stopped for him. He got in and set the satchel on the floor and rubbed his hands together between his knees. The driver leaned across him and tried the door and then pulled the tall gear lever down into first, and they set out.
That door don't shut good. Where are you going?
San Antonio.
Well, I'm going as far as Brady, Texas.
I appreciate it.
You a cattle buyer?
Sir. The man nodded at the satchel with its straps and brass catches.
I said, are you a cattle buyer?
No, sir, that's just my suitcase.
I lied, maybe you's a cattle buyer. How long you been standing out there?
Just a few minutes. The man pointed to a plastic knob on the dash that glowed a dull orange color.
This thing's got a heater in it, but it don't put out much. Can you feel it?
Yes, sir. Feels pretty good to me. The man nodded at the gray and malignant dawn. He moved his leveled hand slowly before him.
You see that?
He said. Yes, sir. He shook his head.
I despise the winter time. Never did see what was the use in there even being one.
He looked at John Grady.
You don't talk much, do you?
He said. Not a whole lot.
That's a good trait to have.
It was about a 2-hour drive to Brady. They drove through the town, and the man led him out on the other side.
You stay on 87 when you get to Fredericksburg. Don't get off on 290, you wind up in Austin. You hear?
Yes, sir, I appreciate it. He shut the door, and the man nodded and lifted one hand, and the car turned around in the road and went back. The next car by stopped, and he climbed in.
How far are you going?
The man said. Snow was falling in the San Saba when they crossed it, and snow was falling on the Edwards Plateau and in the Balcones, The limestone was white with snow, and he sat watching out while the gray flakes flared over the windshield glass in the sweep of the wipers. A translucent slush had begun to form along the edge of the blacktop, and there was ice on the bridge over the Pedernales. The green water sliding slowly away past the dark bankside trees. The mesquites by the road, so thick with mistletoe they looked like live oaks. The driver sat hunched up over the wheel, whistling silently to himself. They got into San Antonio at 3 o'clock in the afternoon in a driving snowstorm, and he climbed out and thanked the man and walked up the street and into the first cafe he came to and sat at the counter and put the satchel on the stool beside him. He took the little paper menu out of the holder and opened it and looked at it and looked at the clock on the back wall. The waitress set a glass of water in front of him. "Is it the same time here as it is in San Angelo?" he said.
"I knew you was going to ask me something like that," she said. "You had that look."
"Do you not know?
I never been in San Angelo, Texas in my life."
"Well, I'd like a cheeseburger and a chocolate milk."
"Are you here for the rodeo?"
"No."
"It's the same time,"
said a man down the counter.
He thanked him. "Same time," man said, "same time."
She finished writing on her pad and looked up.
"I wouldn't go by nothing," he said.
He walked around town in the snow. It grew dark early. He stood on the Commerce Street Bridge and watched the snow vanish in the river. There was snow on the parked cars, and the traffic in the street by dark had slowed to nothing. A few cabs or trucks, headlights making slowly through the falling snow and passing in a soft rumble of tires. He checked into the YMCA on Martin Street and paid $2 for his room and went upstairs. He took off his boots and stood them on the radiator, and took off his socks and draped them over the radiator beside the boots, and hung up his coat and stretched out on the bed with his hat over his eyes. At 10 till 8, he was standing in front of the box office in his clean shirt with his money in his hand. He bought a seat in the balcony, third row, and paid $1.25 for it. "I never been here before," he said.
"It's a good seat,"
the girl said. He thanked her and went in and tendered his ticket to an usher who led him over to the red-carpeted stairs and handed him the ticket back. He went up and found his seat and sat waiting with his hat in his lap. The theater was half empty. When the lights dimmed, some of the people in the balcony about him got up and moved forward to seats in front. Then the curtain rose, and his mother came through a door on stage and began talking to a woman in a chair. At the intermission, he rose and put on his hat and went down to the lobby and stood in a gilded alcove and rolled a cigarette and stood smoking it with one boot jacked back against the wall behind him. He was not unaware of the glances that drifted his way from the theatergoers. He turned up one leg of his jeans into a small cuff, and from time to time he leaned and tipped into this receptacle the soft white ash of his cigarette. He saw a few men in boots and hats, and he nodded gravely to them, they to him. After a while, the lights in the lobby dimmed again. He sat leaning forward in the seat, with his elbows on the empty seat back in front of him and his chin on his forearms, and he watched the play with great intensity. He'd the notion that there would be something in the story itself to tell him about the way the world was or was becoming, but there was not. There was nothing in it at all. When the lights came up, there was applause, and his mother came forward several times, and all the cast assembled across the stage and held hands and bowed, and then the curtain closed for good, and the audience rose and made their way up the aisles. He sat for a long time in the empty theater, and then he stood and put on his hat and went out into the cold. When he set out in the morning to get his breakfast, it was still dark, and the temperature stood at zero. There was half a foot of snow on the ground in Travis Park. The only cafe open was a Mexican one, and he ordered huevos rancheros and coffee and sat looking through the paper. He thought there'd be something in the paper about his mother, but there wasn't. He was the only customer in the cafe. The waitress was a young girl, and she watched him. When she set the platter down, he put the paper aside and pushed his cup forward.
Más café? She said.
Sí, por favor. She brought the coffee.
Hace mucho frío, she said.
Bastante. He walked up Broadway with his hands in his coat pockets and his collar turned up against the wind. He walked into the lobby of the Menger Hotel and sat in one of the lounge chairs and crossed one boot over the other and opened the paper. She came through the lobby about 9 o'clock. She was on the arm of a man in a suit and a topcoat, and they went out the door and got into a cab. He sat there for a long time. After a while, he got up and folded the paper and went to the desk. The clerk looked up at him. "Have you got a Mrs. Cole registered?" he said.
"Cole?"
"Yes. Just a minute." The clerk turned away and checked the registrations. He shook his head.
"No," he said. "No Cole."
"Thanks," he said. They rode together a last time on a day in early March, when the weather had already warmed and yellow Mexican hat bloomed by the roadside. They unloaded the horses at McCullough's and rode up through the middle pasture along Grape Creek and into the low hills. The creek was clear and green with trailing moss braided over the gravel bars. They rode slowly up through the open country among scrub mesquite and nopal. They crossed from Tom Green County into Coke County. They crossed the old Schoonover Road and rode up through broken hills dotted with cedar where the ground was cobbled with trap rock, and they could see snow on the thin blue ranges 100 miles to the north. They scarcely spoke all day. His father rode sitting forward slightly in the saddle, holding the reins in one hand about 2 inches above the saddle horn. So thin and frail, lost in his clothes. Looking over the country with those sunken eyes as if the world out there had been altered or made suspect by what he'd seen of it elsewhere, as if he might never see it right again, or worse, did see it right at last, see it as it had always been, would forever be. The boy who rode on slightly before him sat a horse not only as if he'd been born to it, which he was, but as if, were he begot by malice or mischance into some queer land where horses never were, he would have found them anyway, would have known that there was something missing for the world to be right, or he right in it, and would have set forth to wander wherever it was needed for as long as it took until he came upon one, and he would have known that that was what he sought, and it would have been. In the afternoon, they passed through the ruins of an old ranch on that stony mesa where there were crippled fence posts propped among the rocks that carried remnants of a wire not seen in that country for years. An ancient picket house, the wreckage of an old wooden windmill fallen among the rocks. They rode on. They walked ducks up out of potholes, and in the evening they descended through low rolling hills and across the red clay floodplain into the town of Robert Lee. They waited until the road was clear before they walked the horses over the board bridge. The river was red with mud. They rode up Commerce Street and turned up 7th and rode up Austin Street past the bank and dismounted and tied their horses in front of the cafe and went in. The proprietor came over to take their order. He called them by name. His father looked up from the menu.
"Go ahead and order," he said. "He won't be here for an hour."
"What are you having?"
"I think I'll just have some pie and coffee."
"What kind of pie you got?" the boy said. The proprietor looked toward the counter.
"Go on and get something to eat," his father said. "I know you're hungry."
They ordered, and the proprietor brought their coffee and went back to the counter. His father took a cigarette out of his shirt pocket.
"You thought any more about boarding your horse?"
"Yeah," the boy said. "Thought about it."
"Wallace might let you feed and swamp out stalls and such as that. Trade it out that way."
"He ain't gonna like it."
"Who, Wallace?"
"No, Redbow." His father smoked. He watched him.
"You still seeing that Barnett girl?"
He shook his head.
"She quit you or did you quit her?"
"I don't know."
"I mean, she quit you."
"Yeah." His father nodded. He smoked. Two horsemen passed outside in the road, and they studied them and the animals they rode. His father stirred his coffee a long time. There was nothing to stir because he drank it black. He took the spoon and laid it, smoking, on the paper napkin, and raised the cup and looked at it and drank. He was still looking out the window, although there was nothing there to see. Your mother and me never agreed on a whole lot. She liked horses, and I thought that was enough. That's how dumb I was. She was young, and I thought she'd outgrow some of the notions she had, but she didn't. Maybe they were just notions to me. It wasn't just the war. We were married 10 years before the war come along. She left out of here. She was gone from the time you were 6 months old till you were about 3. I know you know something about that, and it was a mistake not to have told you. We separated. She was in California. Luisa looked after you, her and Abuela. He looked at the boy, and he looked out the window again. She wanted me to go out there, he said. Why didn't you? I did. I didn't last long at it. The boy nodded. She come back because of you, not me. I guess that's what I wanted to say. Yes, sir. The proprietor brought the boy's dinner and the pie. The boy reached for the salt and pepper. He didn't look up. The proprietor brought the coffee pot and filled their cups and went away. His father stubbed out his cigarette and picked up his fork and stabbed at the pie with it. She's going to be around a lot longer than me. I'd like to see you all make up your differences. The boy didn't answer. I wouldn't be here if it wasn't for her. When I was in Goshi, I'd talk to her by the hour. I made her out to be like somebody who could do anything. I'd tell her about some of the other old boys that I didn't think was going to make it, and I'd ask her to look after them and to pray for them. Some of them did make it, too. I guess I was a little crazy, part of the time anyway. But if it hadn't have been for her, I wouldn't have made it. No way in this world. I never told that to anybody. She don't even know it. The boy ate. Outside it was growing dark. His father drank coffee. They waited for Arturo to come with the truck. The last thing his father said was that the country would never be the same. People don't feel safe no more, he said. We're like the Comanches was 200 years ago. We don't know what's going to show up here come daylight. We don't even know what color they'll be. The night was almost warm. He and Rawlins lay in the road where they could feel the heat coming off the blacktop against their backs, and they watched stars falling down the long black slope of the firmament. In the distance they heard a door slam. A voice called. A coyote that had been yammering somewhere in the hills to the south stopped. Then it began again. Is that somebody hollering for you? He said. Probably, said Rawlins. They lay spread-eagled on the blacktop like captives waiting some trial at dawn. You told your old man? Said Rawlins. No. You going to? What would be the point in it? When do you all have to be out? Closing's 1st of June. You could wait till then. What for? Rawlins propped the heel of one boot atop the toe of the other, as if to pace off the heavens. My daddy ran off from home when he was 15. Otherwise, I'd have been born in Alabama. You wouldn't have been born at all. What makes you say that? Because your mama's from San Angelo and he never would have met her. He'd have met somebody. So would she. So? So you wouldn't have been born. Well, I don't see why you say that. I'd have been born somewheres. How? Well, why not? If your mama had a baby with her other husband and your daddy had one with his other wife, which one would you be? I wouldn't be neither of them. That's right. Rawlins lay watching the stars. After a while, he said, I could still be born.
I might look different or something. If God wanted me to be born, I'd be born. And if he didn't, you wouldn't. You're making my goddamn head hurt. I know it. I'm making my own. They lay watching the stars. So what do you think? He said.
I don't know, said Rawlins.
Well, I can understand if you was from Alabama, you'd have every reason in the world to run off to Texas. But if you're already in Texas, I don't know. You got a lot more reason for leaving than me.
What the hell reason you got for staying? You think somebody's going to die and leave you something?
Shit, no.
That's good, because they ain't. The door slammed. The voice called again.
I better get back, Rawlins said.
He rose and swiped at the seat of his jeans with one hand and put his hat on.
If I don't go, will you go anyways?
John Grady sat up and put his hat on. I'm already gone, he said. He saw her one last time in town. He'd been to Cullen Cole's shop on North Chadbourne to get a broken bridle bit welded, and he was coming up to Higg Street when she came out of the Cactus Drug. He crossed the street, but she called to him, and he stopped and waited while she came over. "Were you avoiding me?" she said. He looked at her. "I guess I didn't have any thoughts about it one way or the other." She watched him. "A person can't help the way they feel," she said.
"That's good all the way around, ain't it?"
"I thought we could be friends."
He nodded. "It's all right. I ain't gonna be around here all that much longer."
"Where are you going?"
"I ain't at liberty to say."
"Why ever not?"
"I just ain't."
He looked at her. She was studying his face.
"What do you think he'd say if he seen you standing here talking to me?"
"He's not jealous."
"That's good. That's a good trait to have. Save him a lot of aggravation."
"What does that mean?"
"I don't mean nothing. I got to go."
"Do you hate me?"
"No."
"You don't like me?" He looked at her.
"You're wearing me out, girl," he said. "What difference does it make? If you got a bad conscience, just tell me what you want me to say and I'll say it."
"It wouldn't be you saying it. Anyway, I don't have a bad conscience. I just thought we could be friends."
He shook his head. "It's just talk, Mary Catherine. I got to get on."
"What if it is just talk? Everything's talk, isn't it?"
"Not everything."
"Are you really leaving San Angelo?"
"Yeah."
"You'll be back?"
"Maybe."
"I don't have any bad feelings against you."
"You got no reason to."
She looked off up the street where he was looking, but there wasn't much to look at. She turned back and he looked at her eyes. But if they were wet, it was just the wind. She held out her hand. At first, he didn't know what she was doing.
"I don't wish you anything but the best," she said.
He took her hand, small in his, familiar. He'd never shaken hands with a woman before.
"Take care of yourself," she said.
"Thank you, I will." He stood back and touched the brim of his hat and turned and went on up the street. He didn't look back, but he could see her in the windows of the federal building across the street, standing there, and she was still standing there when he reached the corner and stepped out of the glass forever. He dismounted and opened the gate and walked the horse through and closed the gate and walked the horse along the fence. He dropped down to see if he could skylight Rawlins, but Rawlins wasn't there. He dropped the reins at the fence corner and watched the house. The horse sniffed the air and pushed its nose against his elbow.
"That you, bud?"
Rawlins whispered.
"You better hope so."
Rawlins walked the horse down and stood and looked back at the house.
"You ready?" said John Grady.
"Yeah."
"They suspect anything?"
"Nah."
"Well, let's go."
"Hang on a minute. I just piled everything on top of the horse and walked him out here."
John Grady picked up the reins and swung up into the saddle.
"Yonder goes a light," he said.
"Damn!
You'll be late for your own funeral."
"It ain't even four yet. You're early."
"Well, let's go. There goes the barn."
Rawlins was trying to get his sugan tied on behind the saddle,
There's a switch in the kitchen, he said. He ain't to the barn yet. He might not even be going out there. He might just be getting him a glass of milk or something.
He might just be loading a shotgun or something.
Rawlins mounted up. You ready? He said.
I've been ready.
They rode out along the fence line and across the open pasture land. The leather creaked in the morning cold. They pushed the horses into a lope. The lights fell away behind them. They rode out on the high prairie where they slowed the horses to a walk, and the stars swarmed around them out of the blackness. They heard somewhere in that tenantless night a bell that tolled and ceased where no bell was, and they rode out on the round dais of the earth, which alone was dark and no light to it, and which carried their figures and bore them up into the swarming stars, so that they rode not under but among them. And they rode at once jaunty and circumspect, like thieves newly loosed in that dark electric, like young thieves in a glowing orchard, loosely jacketed against the cold and 10,000 worlds for the choosing. By noon the day following, they'd made some 40 miles, still in country they knew. Crossing the old Mark Fury ranch in the night where they'd dismounted at the cross fences for John Grady to pull the staples with a cat's paw and stand on the wires, while Rawlins led the horses through and then raised the wires back and beat the staples into the posts and put the cat's paw back in his saddlebag and mount up to ride on.
How the hell did they expect a man to ride a horse in this country? Said Rawlins.
They don't, said John Grady. They rode the sun up and ate the sandwiches John Grady had brought from the house, and at noon they watered the horses at an old stone stock tank and walked them down a dry creek bed among the tracks of cattle and javelina to a stand of cottonwoods. There were cattle bedded under the trees that rose at their approach and stood looking at them and then moved off. They lay in the dry chaff under the trees with their coats rolled up under their heads and their hats over their eyes while the horses grazed in the grass along the creek bed.
"What did you bring to shoot?" said Rawlins.
"Just Granddad's old thumb buster."
"Can you hit anything with it?"
"No." Rawlins grinned.
"We done it, didn't we?"
"Yeah."
"You think they'll be hunting us?"
"What for?"
"I don't know, just seems too damn easy in a way."
They could hear the wind, and they could hear the sound of the horses cropping.
"I'll tell you what," said Rawlins.
"Tell me."
"I don't give a damn."
John Grady sat up and took his tobacco from his shirt pocket and began making a cigarette.
"About what?" he said.
He wet the cigarette and put it in his mouth and took out his matches and lit the cigarette and blew the match out with the smoke. He turned and looked at Rawlins, but Rawlins was asleep. They rode on again in the late afternoon. By sunset, they could hear trucks on a highway in the distance, and in the long, cool evening, they rode west, along a rise from which they could see the headlights on the highway going out and coming back, random and periodic in their slow exchange. They came to a ranch road and followed it out to the highway where there was a gate. They sat the horses. They could see no gate on the far side of the highway. They watched the lights of the trucks along the fence, both east and west, but there was no gate there.
"What do you want to do?" said Rawlins.
"I don't know. I'd like to have got across this thing tonight."
"I ain't leading my horse down that highway in the dark."
John Grady leaned and spat.
"I ain't either," he said.
It was growing colder. The wind rattled the gate, and the horses stepped uneasily.
"What's them lights?" said Rawlins.
"I'd make it El Dorado."
"How far is that, you reckon?"
10-15 miles.
"What do you want to do?"
They spread their bedrolls in a wash and unsaddled and tied the horses and slept till daybreak. When Rawlins sat up, John Grady had already saddled his horse and was strapping on his bedroll.
"There's a cafe up the road here," he said. "Could you eat some breakfast?"
Rawlins put on his hat and reached for his boots.
"You're talking my language, son."
They led the horses up through a midden of old truck doors and transmissions and cast-off motor parts behind the cafe, and they watered them at a metal tank used for locating leaks in inner tubes. A Mexican was changing a tire on a truck, and John Grady walked over and asked him where the men's room was. He nodded down the side of the building.
He got his shaving things out of his saddlebag and went into the washroom and shaved and washed and brushed his teeth and combed his hair. When he came out, the horses were tied to a picnic table under some trees, and Rollins was in the cafe drinking coffee. He slid into the booth. "You ordered?" he said. "Waiting on you."